Who's willing to admit that they have the gift of anger? A lot of people, including my in-laws, who I lived with for 10 months at one point, don't believe that I can get angry. They think I'm very laid back and easygoing, and that's how I like to present myself. So if you're thinking the same thing, absolutely. I don't want to burst that bubble. I am laid back and easygoing. But maybe it's not listed in the spiritual gifts inventory, but if you've ever felt that heat bubbling up in your chest, if you've ever stepped into something that's unfair, or you said something you've regretted in that moment, you're not alone. We're with you. I get it personally. And believe it or not, anger might not be the enemy that we've made it out to be. In fact, it might even be a gift. And that's why I called it the gift of anger. But that is if we let Jesus get a hold of it. Now, I've admitted before that when I'm preparing for a message, I often wrestle through the issues myself. And anger's not a fun one to be working on, because this week I just felt like different things were setting me off. And Amanda's like, what's going on? I'm like, well, I'm preaching on anger this week. But I grew up in a very loving household. Don't get me wrong. My parents are awesome. But I also grew up trying to avoid feeling my emotions, feeling any type of sadness. I wanted to be happy-go-lucky all the time. But one way that I learned how to avoid being vulnerable when I would feel these emotions was to actually get angry. And in my household, I don't know if it's just because I grew up in a house of boys, but anger was a justified emotion, more than sadness would have been. So I learned over time that if I was angry, if I was able to put on a brave face, well, then people wouldn't mess with me. They would just kind of leave me alone. And if I was angry, I could justify things that I wouldn't normally do or get away with. My parents would kind of step back and be like, oh, Kevin's just angry. We'll let him air out his frustrations. But I also discovered over time that it was kind of cool to be angry. Like, especially as you're growing up and you're trying to kind of discover your identity. I know, especially for me, when you're a teen, you kind of have this angst and it's cool. Like, you look strong and tough. And I've recently watched a documentary, don't judge me on this, but on the Jerry Springer Show. It came on Netflix and I'm like, I'm interested in knowing what was going on here, because that was a show that I would sometimes watch from time to time, as long as my mom didn't overhear what I was watching and tell me to change the channel. But late 90s, early 2000s, right around when I was forming a lot of my beliefs and opinions and who I was, it was all the rage to be angry. It was all the rage to go crazy and lose it on people and give people a piece of your mind, because anger got attention. Anger got results. And as I started driving, it transferred over there. Anger helped me get my way. It was all about me, my way or the highway. And if someone else was angry with me, I learned that I just had to out crazy their anger. And if I got angrier than them, well, then they'd back down. And it was this vicious cycle, but it was my mindset until one particular night. I just picked up my friends, Ben and Dan. We were down Upper Stony Creek. I still remember the intersection I got to, but I'm driving down Stone Church Road, and it's about 50 kilometer an hour road by Janet Lee. I'm doing about 70, and this little red Civic blows through a stop sign to get in front of me and then drops down to about 40 kilometers an hour. I'm like, are you kidding me? So I'm revving my engine, pulling up on their back end, getting frustrated, and I'm trying to scare them and let them know I'm angry. Don't do this. Well, then we make a left turn and we get to a four-way stop, and I'm trying to look in the mirror, and it looks like it's a little old lady with a nice little headband, and I'm like, great, she's going to learn her lesson. She'll never do it again. Well, the door opened and this guy got out, and his muscles were the size of my head, and I'm thinking, I'm done. So I rolled down my window a crack and I'm like, sorry. And I zoomed through the intersection and got by as fast as I could. But anger is such a tricky emotion because here I was feeling so much rage, so much anger, I'm going to get my way. And then I suddenly, quickly had that anger disappear when I realized my life was in jeopardy. But it's complicated, it's powerful, and it's everywhere. It was loud when I was growing up, and I think it might even be louder today. So as Christians and followers of Jesus, or if you've been around the church for any length of time, you've probably been presented with a different understanding of anger. Chances are, if I had to guess, you were taught to deny it, to suppress it. Don't get angry. Don't allow it. Maybe you heard that anger was a sign that you were in your sinful flesh, Romans 8:3. But if we learn over time to suppress our anger, or simply rename it, I'm not angry, I'm frustrated, I'm not angry, I'm annoyed, we keep sweeping it under the carpet and we're not dealing with what it's trying to tell us. Because the thing is, when we suppress our feelings and we're too ashamed to name them, well, we end up denying them and we call it discipline, or we ignore them and we lie to others and ourselves about our real feelings. And where it gets even more complicated is that we all come from different families, different cultures, different communities, including church communities, which handled anger differently. And within each community, there's different ways that anger is handled. So think about it for a moment. How did your family handle anger? Amanda and I had to learn this the hard way when we first got married, because she grew up in with a sister, I grew up with a brother. We'd fight it out, they'd write letters to each other. Well, when Amanda and I came together, we couldn't figure it out the same way that we both grew up figuring things out. Or how have the churches that you've belonged to expressed anger? And to what degree does your ethnic culture make room for anger? For many of us, I would guess that it's been suffocated and suppressed. And when that happens, we end up living these incomplete lives, which lead to self-deception and emotional hiding. And this was my story. So the question isn't about whether or not you have anger. The question is, to what level and in what ways has anger influenced your life? So let's talk about the gift beneath the fire. Because I believe that there is a gift beneath the fire. Now, I should also mention, I don't have any slides today. Part of that is because we don't have a tech person. Part of that is because there were so many other things we focused on this week that I just didn't get around to making slides. So you've just got me. But I believe that there's a gift beneath the fire. And I believe that most of us have missed seeing it as a gift. You see, it might sound strange, but it's true. Anger is a way to appropriately respond to the incongruities and injustices of life. Anger can be a way to kind of release the pressure valve of our souls when life surprises us and wounds us. So anger, in the healthiest sense, helps us identify what needs to be made right. It's a signal alerting us. But it's important to note, however, that anger is what we call a secondary emotion. It's a symptom of a deeper angst. It often masks something else: pain, fear, shame, hurt. So when something's off, we get angry because something we value is being threatened. But oftentimes we get caught in the emotion of anger that we don't do the deeper work of digging below the surface. So with that all being said, anger is not always the enemy. Jesus himself, as we're going to see, got angry. One day Jesus shows up at the temple, which was a place for worship and community, and he ends up flipping tables. I'm sure many of us know that story when we're getting upset and our wives are telling us to calm down and we're like, well, Jesus flipped tables. Now, Jesus isn't angry about someone cutting him off in traffic. Jesus is angry because people, poor people specifically, were being exploited. So Jesus fashions a whip, he flips some tables, and he drives the leaders out because he's having none of it. He's saying, not in my Father's house. These people were coming to make sacrifices, but they were being charged exorbitant amounts to buy these animals, to make sacrifices that they couldn't afford. And that's where Jesus is saying, no, not in my house. Well, another example of Jesus being angry is in Mark's Gospel, chapter 3. I'll read it. You can follow along in the Bibles if you have yours with you, or there's red ones in the seats in front of you. Mark chapter 3. It says, another time Jesus went into the synagogue. A man with a weak and twisted hand was there. Some Pharisees were trying to find fault with Jesus. They watched him closely. They wanted to see if he would heal the man on the Sabbath day. Jesus spoke to the man with the weak and twisted hand. Stand up in front of everyone, he said. Then Jesus asked them, what does the law say we should do on the Sabbath day? Should we do good or should we do evil? Should we save life or should we kill? But no one answered. Jesus looked around at them in anger. He was very upset because their hearts were stubborn. Then he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand had become as good as new. On both these occasions, Jesus' anger emerged because people, specifically the poor and the marginalized, were being mistreated. And interestingly, he never responds with anger when people mistreat him. It's always in defense of others. And that's important because most of our anger isn't rooted in justice, it's rooted in ego. Jesus got angry when others were being mistreated. We usually get angry when our preferences or pride are threatened. You see, in the right hands, anger can lead to justice. It can energize us to stand up for the vulnerable. It can move us to make things right. But in the wrong hands, and when it's left unchecked, anger can actually destroy us. Jesus says this in his Sermon on the Mount. So this is in Matthew's Gospel. The Sermon on the Mount is chapters 5 through 7. So in Matthew chapter 5, starting in verse 21, it says, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raca, is answerable to the court, and anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Now, it's important to note the placement of where this is within Jesus' sermon, because in the previous chapter, before Jesus gets to this section on anger, he highlights the superficial righteousness of the Pharisees. And the Pharisees were this group of religious people who meant well. They you could say, thought they had their heart in the right place. But there was this collective spirit of spiritual pride. They would make boundaries to kind of determine who's in and who's out. They focused on the external behavior. So what does Jesus do? Well, Jesus raises the bar. He's not just interested in our external behavior. He's after our hearts. Our external behavior, he knows it will naturally flow out of what he does on the inside. But the Pharisees didn't care about what was going on the inside. They just wanted to see the good works. You probably heard the saying, my dad used to always say, now it's not coming to me, don't date girls who smoke or chew or girls who do, something like that. And it's kind of, again, this focus on the externals saying, you don't drink? Okay, good, you're in. Oh, you do drink? Okay, you're out. Oh, you smoke? You're out. You don't? You're in. But we're not focusing on what's going on the inside. We're having this checklist. The Pharisees didn't care about what was going on the inside. They wanted to see the good works. But remember in the Beatitudes that we looked at a few weeks ago, it says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. True faithfulness comes from inner transformation. And let's face it, if you were listening to Jesus' sermon and you were one of the Pharisees, you would be angry with this message, which is kind of ironic. Because here's the twist. The great sin of the deeply religious isn't rebellion, it's resentment. Think of the older brother in the parable of the prodigal son. The older brother obeys all the rules. He stays at home. He does everything right. The younger brother takes off, squanders all of his wealth, just does whatever he wants, and then comes back home with nothing, and he receives grace. And the older brother could not handle it. To the legalist, grace isn't generous. It's offensive. It's scandalous even, because it gives to those who don't deserve. And that makes the so-called deserving furious. So the religious leaders of the day thought they were spiritually healthy because, well, hey, I'm not killing anyone, so I'm doing good. But Jesus raises the bar. He isn't interested in just avoiding murder. He's interested in what's going on in the heart. And he's saying, if you're feeling those things in your heart, it's just like doing it. He's raising the bar, not to shame us, but to actually free us from anger, from bitterness, from resentment, all the things that he knows will slowly eat away at our hearts. And according to him, if you're angry with your brother or sister, you're subject to judgment. And the anger Jesus names is very specific. In Greek, it's orgazomenos. And it's written in the present tense, which means it refers to someone who's continuously angry. A biblical scholar points out that this could be translated as carrying anger or remaining angry or even nursing a grudge. So Jesus isn't criticizing a single moment of anger. He doesn't say whoever gets angry. He's warning us about the kind of anger that we carry around with us. The anger that we feed and that we refuse to release. Dallas Willard describes carrying anger this way. It's energy dedicated to keeping the anger alive, constantly reminding ourselves of how wrongly we've been treated. That's what this word that Jesus uses entails. When rage becomes the default mode of our lives, sooner or later it weighs us down. Have you ever gone to a grocery store and it feels like everyone in the community has had the exact same idea? And they're there, you have to park the back corner, you walk in, all the grocery carts are gone, and then you pick up one of those baskets and you start loading it, and you're going up and down the aisles. Sooner or later, that cart starts burning your arm. That's what carrying anger is like. It builds over time, and we start carrying it around with us, and resentment builds, and we get frustrated and angry, and we let it build little by little, and before long, we're completely crushed by it. Aristotle has been attributed with this quote, "He is a fool who cannot be angry, but he is wise who will not remain so." There's part of it where it's like we have to allow ourselves to feel human emotions, but we don't remain there. We let Jesus transform it. So how do you know if you're harboring unhealthy anger? Well, Jesus gives us the two examples in verse 22. By calling a brother or sister raca and anyone who says you fool. Now, raca isn't a word that we use today. Other than when I told my kids some of the message yesterday and they started using that word. And I said, no, the Bible tells us not to. But we've got plenty of modern day equivalents, like the words fool, idiot, jerk, stupid. What makes raca so serious, though, in Jesus' day is that this was a dehumanizing insult, a word used to strip someone of dignity. It wasn't just a passing comment. It was meant to cut deep and to label someone as beneath you. So to give it weight in today's world, it would be like using a racial slur or a deeply offensive term, something intentional that was crafted to offend, wound, and degrade. And Jesus says that kind of anger, when it takes shape in our words, is dangerous. not just to others, but to our own souls. That's Raqqa. And if you haven't noticed, we live in a Raqqa world. Rich Velotis, in his book, The Narrow Path, he points out that in our society, anger is nurtured and rewarded. We are formed to see others as the root problems of society, justifying our anger toward them. Democrat, Raqqa. Republican, Raqqa. Immigrant, Raqqa. Gay person, Raqqa. Pro-life person, Raqqa. Atheist, Raqqa. Baptist, Raqqa. And on the list goes. But here's Jesus' point. To carry and nurse the kind of anger that leads us to dehumanize others is the same as murder in God's eyes and subjects us to judgment and the power of hell. So here's the thing. If you've ever experienced that kind of deep anger or hatred toward someone, you know it can feel justified in the moment. But the truth is you're already living in a kind of hell. So be careful, because anger is not a fruit of the Spirit. And it's easy to trick ourselves into believing it is. We say things like, it's righteous anger, or I'm standing up for truth, or I'm just saying it like it is. But here's the thing. If Jesus says this kind of anger is destructive, then we as his followers must make every effort to rid ourselves of it. Because anger that isn't surrendered to the Spirit will always pull us further away from the heart of God. And that's where anger can be the signal to understand what's going on within us, but also a reminder to release it and surrender it to Jesus. Have you ever wondered, how does someone become filled with that kind of anger? I'm sure most of us could answer that fairly quickly, but have you ever thought beyond just, well, the guy cut me off in traffic and this happened and I didn't get my way? Like, is it a personality flaw? Is it just a bad habit? Is it wiring issues? Like, we see anger everywhere. We see domestic violence, road rage, angry outbursts at our children, self-hatred, resentment that simmers for years. And it doesn't come out of nowhere. I want to take just a quick moment to unpack two of the main sources of this kind of anger: our culture and our interior world. So cultural anger, a 2021 study found something both fascinating and disturbing. Posts, social media posts that were fueled by moral outrage got more likes, shares, and retweets. They get more engagement. In other words, we as a society are rewarding anger, and we're giving it dopamine hits and social currency in the form of new followers. And in some cases, people are even making money off of it. And the more outrage is rewarded, the more outrage we'll keep producing, until we find ourselves caught in this cycle that we don't even realize we're feeding. But here's what's even more concerning. We're constantly trying to locate the problems of the world outside of ourselves. It's easier for us to say, oh, it's them, it's that person, it's that group of people. And we like staying busy pointing the finger at others, because it allows us to stand outside of any critique ourselves. And that's the best way, when you can kind of point at everyone else. But my dad, again, also told me that whenever I'm pointing the finger at someone, I've got three fingers pointing back at me. A few things fuel anger, like self-righteousness. So here's a tough but important question. In what ways are you pointing fingers while ignoring your own shortcomings? Or to put it differently, are you living in a fantasy world where you're always right? The second is interior anger. So of course, not all anger comes from the culture around us. Some of it comes much from much closer to home. It comes from within. And for some of us, anger isn't just something we pick up from the outside world. It's something that we've actually been carrying for years that we haven't unpacked and processed. It could be unhealed wounds from childhood, family dynamics where anger was the only acceptable emotion, disappointments, betrayals, trauma that we never processed, or maybe deep down we carry a belief that just no one sees us or that we're never going to be enough. And instead of dealing with the pain, we bury it until it leaks out sideways in like sarcasm and cynicism, impatience, or these explosive reactions that even surprise us. I like keeping on my facade of that I've got it all together, but I'll peel back the layers with this one story that when I was leaving my youth pastorate out west, I didn't realize at the time I was sad. I was carrying sadness. It had been just a phenomenal ministry. We had great friends, and we just loved the kids that we were serving. And I was, my last Sunday was coming up, and on the Friday night, the board got together and we had a Christmas party because I was leaving in December, and it was the last time we were all going to be together. And after the party had ended, Amanda and I were driving back home and someone cut me off on the road and I just went ballistic. Like, I won't go into details because it was bad. She was pregnant with Landon at the time. She actually got out of the car when I got to a red light and she's like, I'm walking home. And I'm like, good. And I drove off home. And then I felt bad once I got home and went back looking for her. It was bad. But I had just started the process of counseling, which ended up going for another decade. But I realized as I sat and actually used that anger as a signal saying, what's going on beneath? I realized that I was sad. I was heartbroken. I was carrying this grief. And I think unaddressed pain will always find an expression. And for many of us, that expression is anger. So I think the gift of anger is that it signals to us that something else is going on. Because when we don't deal with our anger, it doesn't just stay in us, it leaks. It affects our home life. It shapes the atmosphere at our church. If we're not careful, we end up passing it along, not just to others, but even to the next generation. So while our culture might reward outrage, it's often our interior world that's fueling it. And that's where Jesus comes along. And he doesn't say, stop being angry. He says, look deeper. He wants to heal what's going on underneath. He wants us to bring our hearts to him, not just our behavior. He wants us to bring this pain into the light of his love. So how do we resist the pull of anger? Well, I love that Jesus doesn't just give us a checklist. He gives us something far more relational. In the very next verses in Matthew chapter 5, verses 23 and 24, says, therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar, first go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. Jesus is making it clear that your relationship with God isn't as good as you think it is if your relationship with someone else is broken, or if you're carrying and harboring unresolved anger toward someone. Now, this doesn't always mean you need to go to that person. And what I mean by that is people have hurt us. There are times when boundaries have to be in place. But we still need to bring that pain, resentment, anger, bitterness to God and let him heal it. and release it to him. I remember I was really angry with someone growing up, and when I was doing an internship in Mississauga, I asked the pastor if I should go meet with this one specific person. And the pastor just asked, what would that accomplish? And I mainly just wanted to kind of hurt him by bringing it up. And I realized that it wasn't something that I had to actually go and reconcile with this person. It was more of an anger and a resentment that was within me that I was carrying. You can't claim to be walking closely with God while holding contempt for your neighbor. In fact, Jesus says, pause your worship if you have to. Go make it right, then come back. And what's interesting is that Jesus is talking to an audience that would likely travel long distances to Jerusalem to perform these rituals. But what he's saying is that reconciliation matters more than ritual, more than just going through the motions. You see, reconciliation isn't a footnote in our faith. It's the very heart of it. And maybe there's someone you need to reach out to, a conversation you've been avoiding, a message you've been putting off. And if so, don't ignore that nudge. But Jesus also might just be inviting you to take a step toward him for healing, for forgiveness, and with help letting those things go. Jesus is speaking to the urgency of the moment. He knows how quickly a spark of anger can grow into this consuming fire. So he's teaching us to guard our hearts against a power that seeks to destroy us. And not just us, but our relationships and our witness. Jesus wants to get to the root, to dig beneath the surface of our anger and to make room for the healing, transforming power of God. So how do we partner with him in that work? One of the most powerful ways is through a practice called lament. And it's a biblical practice of just bringing our pain, confusion, even our anger, honestly before God. It's not pretending everything's okay. It's not stuffing our emotions down. It's choosing to bring it into the presence of the one who can actually handle them and heal them. There are legitimate reasons to be angry, but in the kingdom of God, there's no legitimate reason to let that anger consume you and destroy what matters most. Because anger closes us in, but lament opens us up. It creates space in our hearts for the Spirit of God to move and to soften us and to redirect us to get to the root of what's going on beneath. And like I've said, the root of rage is often grief. That's why slowing down to lament, I believe, needs to become a regular part of our worship, in our gatherings, in our conversations with trusted friends, even in the quiet moments that we spend with God, where we just bring those wounds before him. Because unless we face our anger honestly and in the presence of God, we end up violating the law of love that we've been called to live by. Paul's command to the church in Ephesus is helpful here. He writes, "Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger and give no opportunity to the devil." In other words, yes, you can be angry. Allow yourself to feel it, but pay attention to what it's signaling. Don't let it take over. Don't let it rule you, because anger, if left unchecked, has the power to enslave you. Or as James puts it, everyone should be quick to listen and slow to speak and slow to become angry. And the good news of the gospel is this: the Lord is slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. You can just take a look at the track record through scripture, through those who've gone before us. God's people throughout history, there are repeated failures, rebellion, stubbornness. One moment they're praising God, the next moment they're turning their back and chasing idols. And yet, God's anger moves in slow motion. Patient, measured. He gives his people opportunity after opportunity to turn back. And when you reflect on those stories, do you see your story in theirs? Because here's the beauty of it. God's anger travels slowly, but his steadfast love races towards you. So hear this. Christ is the one who received the full force of the world's raka, the insults, the contempt, the dehumanizing rejection. And in return, he poured out forgiveness and mercy. So to show up in the world as a follower of Jesus doesn't mean to eliminate all anger, but it does mean living in such a way that it doesn't consume you. You're human. You're going to get angry. But with Christ's love compelling you and his spirit transforming you, anger will not own you. And the good news is that Jesus didn't just teach us about anger. He took it. He bore the contempt of the world so that we could be free. At the cross, love swallowed up wrath and grace disarmed hostility. Jesus, we thank you for the cross, for taking our sin, our shame, and even our anger upon yourself and offering us mercy instead of condemnation. We remember today your body broken for us, your blood poured out so that we might be forgiven and free. Would you take these simple elements, bread and a cup, and use them to nourish our faith and to anchor us in your grace, and to remind us that your love is stronger than our failures. Draw us close to your heart and to one another as we receive these gifts with thankful hearts. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.